1A. I'm Jen White. In 1920, women in the United States won the right to vote by virtue of the passage of the 19th Amendment. But the struggle to attain that right was a long one, fraught with violence, political turmoil, and social upheaval. Many of the earliest activists in the women's suffrage movement didn't even live to cast their ballots. And Black women, who were among the first suffragists, continued to face barriers to voting for decades. So using sound from the past and the voices leading the fight now, we're going to delve into the lives of some of those Black women who were on the front lines of African American activism and ultimately helped all women secure the right to vote. The Mississippi sun bore down on the earth with a heat that made the dirt crack and splinter beneath its fury. Before the rush of summer storms filled the dark soil, quenching the thirst unspoken. The land had always been that way, simultaneously harsh and forgiving, beautiful even with the history that haunted it every day. The whispers of those who came before, the hopes that it drifted up and onto the breeze, carried away like a prayer to the glorious sun. And beneath that beaming beacon in the sky, a small child moved through a cotton field, sweat beading on her brow and dripping, stinging into her eyes. Only 6 years old, her small fingers pulled at the sticky cotton, wincing at the burrs that stuck her, causing tears to prick sharply in the corners of her eyes. Yet they didn't fall. What use would it do when she knew there was no stopping? How could there be? This is where you'll stay. This is what you'll be forever. That's what they wanted her to believe, the white folks who held the land, yet forced her people to work it. The same white folks who begrudgingly agreed that Black people were free, but with limitations, with restraints, with barriers and barricades that locked her so firmly in place, her soul wondered if freedom were possible. If such a thing could be. What true freedom could exist with bars around her humanity, trapping it within a cage of the white imagination, forcing her to spend her hours dreaming of what life might be like if Black people were ever truly freed, if she were freed? And still, the years passed with the monotony of the unchanging Mississippi humidity, ever present and pressing, like the slow storms that rolled in, darkening the sky before releasing a torrent of rain down on the people, on her. And the soil and sweat would flow from her skin back into the earth. But she would dream, because there is freedom in that, in learning how to free oneself. But there is a fight in that too. And she would fight. The little girl, Fannie Lou Hamer, who had spent decades beneath the glare of the sun, bearing the weight of the Jim Crow South on her shoulders, grew into her voice as she grew into adulthood and spoke a truth many weren't yet ready to hear.
Bunk Johnson told me to. This old Jim Crowisms did bad luck to me. I've been traveling from toe to toe. Everywhere I have been, I find some old Jim Crow.
In June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop, was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by the Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, which is Montgomery County, 4 of the people got off to use the washroom. And 2 of the people to use the restaurant. 2 of the people wanted to use the washroom. The 4 people that had gone in to use the restaurant was ordered out. During this time, I was on the bus. But when I looked through the window and saw they had rushed out, I got off of the bus to see what had happened. And one of the ladies said it was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out. I got back on the bus, and one of the persons had used the washroom got back on the bus too. As soon as I was seated on the bus, I saw when they began to get the five people in a highway patrolman's car. I stepped off of the bus to see what was happening, and somebody screamed from the car that the fire workers was in and said, "Get that one there." And when I went to get in the car, when the man told me I was under arrest, he kicked me. I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room.
Fannie Lou Hamer had seen it all in her drive for liberation. She was no stranger to the workings of the Jim Crow South and the harsh measures used to enforce the nationwide caste system. The 19th Amendment states, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." It was ratified on August 18, 1920. On paper, it gives the right to vote to women, while making no mentions of race, as if the complexities of the day never existed. Voting in the South, voting anywhere in the United States as a black person, was rife with trials. The poll taxes, the literacy tests meant to shame black people into believing we had no right or access to the ballot box, weren't there by mistake. They were simply by design. Fannie Lou Hamer knew this and attempted to rectify it after she learned just how far white people would go to prevent black folks from exercising our right to vote, our right to be heard, recognized, and seen.
I was placed in a cell with a young woman called Miss Yvester Simpson. After I was placed in the cell, I began to hear sounds of licks and screams. I could hear the sounds of licks and horrible screams. And I could hear somebody say, "Can you say yes, sir? Can you say yes, sir?" And they would say other horrible names. She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So I said, she said, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her I don't know how long. And after a while, she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on those people. And it wasn't too long before three white men came to my cell. One of these men was a state highway patrolman. And he asked me where I was from. And I told him Roosevelt. He said, "We're going to check this." And they left my cell, and it wasn't too long before they came back. He said, "You are from Roosevelt, all right." And he used a curse word. And he said, "We're going to make you wish you was dead." I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had two Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman, for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
Fannie Lou Hamer died from breast cancer on March 14, 1977. She was only 59 years old and had spent the vast majority of her life as a community organizer and activist. And like lots of us Black women, that meant she was an activist not only for herself, but for all women, all those who were disenfranchised. She couldn't afford not to, but despite all her work, she died in relative obscurity and deep poverty. Writer and civil rights activist Amber J. Phillips often wonders, what would have happened if the movement had come back for Fannie Lou Hamer? What would have happened if they hadn't forgotten her? It's a question that I've wrestled with, too. And it's clear that I'm not the only one who's wondered where Black women are in the history of our movements, especially our voting rights movements.
I mean, you can't be a good historian in 2015, 2019, 2020, and not take an intersectional approach to history and not to wonder, you know, what has the archive honored and what has the archive forgotten? And who has been paying attention to that archive? And if things are not there, and they should be, how are you going to fill in those gaps of that story?
So this is Kate Clark LeMay. She's a historian at the National Portrait Gallery. It's a museum that's part of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. She spent some time showing me around, sharing a bit of history, and what made her want to do an exhibit featuring Black suffragists.
And I, in 2015, was just thinking, you know, where are the Black women in this long history that spans abolitionism, you know, has its roots in all these other social movements and just social justice movements? I wanted to know where the women of color were in this history. And I was, because I was thinking about what I had learned in high school, and it was really just two names, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and maybe Lucy Stone, if you, you know, had some extra time to squeeze in that, you know, more than 15 minutes on women's history.
Okay, sure. Lots of us have probably heard of Susan B. Anthony. And those of us who actually dig history may have even heard of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But it's not like they were in that fight for voting rights alone. Black women were there too, standing alongside them, but their names have been buried beneath, their contributions whitewashed in the books of history.
Why aren't these women who were suffragists, as well as women who were advocating for access to education, for kindergartens, for integrated schools, I mean, why don't we talk about them? And I'm here, I'm thinking about Anna Julia Cooper. I'm thinking about Mary Church Terrell. I'm thinking about Mary McLeod Bethune, Adela Hunt Logan, Ida B. Wells. These are all these very accomplished, educated, you know, activists, earth-moving activists for their time who accomplished so much, and we don't know their names. Which is very frustrating.
The names of the women we remember from the suffragist movement are mainly white women. And when we think about when the suffragist movement began in the U.S., that's on the timetable of white women, too.
And, you know, 1848 becomes a little bit of an arbitrary date. It just sort of fits. It also helps that Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton named it as the beginning of the movement in their history of women's suffrage. It's funny because people like to think that the suffrage movement started in 1848 with the first National Convention of Women at Seneca Falls. And that is a good starting point. I'm not saying that's not an important date, but really the suffrage movement developed out of a long, long, centuries-long effort for women's equality. And you can find writings as far back as Phyllis Wheatley.
She stared down at the paper beneath her hands, and her thoughts burned and flared with memories of times past. To think this is who she was now, a master wordsmith, though she had been born and told she was enslaved, she found freedom in words, in the way they could conjure creation out of nothingness and spin the truth into the light. Phyllis Wheatley dipped her quill into the inkwell and nibbled at its feathered end, stared for a moment at the lines that creased her hands, stories told in the wrinkles of her face, in the ridges of her body. Grounded deeply in her Christian faith, Phyllis wondered how her white peers could profess a love of God while holding her people, people whose skin sang with the same tenderness as the rich brown earth, in perpetual, unceasing bondage. There could be no freedom while black people were enslaved, backs bent beneath the brutal glare of the overseer. So she put pen to paper and wrote. But how presumptuous shall we hope to find divine acceptance with the Almighty mind, while yet, O deed ungenerous, they disgrace and hold in bondage Afric, blameless race. Let virtue reign and then accord our prayers, be victory ours and generous freedom theirs. She had survived, but was she truly free? You're listening to our audio docudrama based on the fight for women's suffrage at the turn of the century. Tuesday marks the centenary of the 19th Amendment. It was finally ratified on August 18th, 1920. Our journey continues in a bit. I'm Jen White, and this is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Black voters play a crucial role for any Democrat who seeks to win the White House, but some big divides amongst that bloc and some serious ambivalence could determine who is elected president this November. Listen now on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. You're listening to a special feature about the fight for women's suffrage and who benefited from that battle. Tomorrow marks the centenary of the 19th Amendment. It was finally ratified on August 18th, 1920. Let's dive back into that journey and hear more from the black women who were on the front lines and how their fight continues all the way to today. 1A correspondent Sasha Ann Simons brings us more.
That's the thing with being a black woman in the U.S. Our fight for freedom and liberation is inextricably tied with those around us. Ida B. Wells is a woman whose investigative journalism uncovered and exposed the mass lynchings of black people throughout the U.S.
In 1892, her best friends, Thomas Moss, and two other black men were lynched for succeeding as grocers. They owned a grocery store, and they refused to comply with the demands of a white group of businessmen, and they got into an argument, and the outcome, long story short, was a mob of white supremacists that lynched these three black men. Ida was totally devastated and began writing about this incident and accused, you know, the white people of lying for their reasons of doing such a thing, murder. And then she went away for the weekend and her offices were burned in Memphis. And basically she realized that, you know, she couldn't stay there. She had to leave, flee for her life.
For years, her name was known mainly to black journalists and others who grew up understanding the importance of the history we aren't taught in our schools. And for years, her contributions went unacknowledged by predominantly white journalistic institutions. Just shy of a century of her death, she was finally awarded a Pulitzer. And in the words of the Pulitzer Committee, it was, quote, for her outstanding and courageous reporting on the horrific and vicious violence against African Americans during the era of lynching. Ida B. Wells knew and understood what a lot of white women refused to acknowledge, and her knowledge would echo in the words of Fannie Lou Hamer decades later. Both women, and other black women like them, would find themselves abandoned by their white peers. Black women who were fighting not only for their own equality, but the equality of black men and other black folks in their life. They were even fighting for those they would never know. And while the goal was the same, liberation and the right to vote, white women, even lauded heroes of the suffragist movement here in the U.S., like Susan B. Anthony, did not see black women as their equals. Their desire and right to vote wasn't so much about equality across the board, but putting them on equal footing with white men, leaving the power dynamics of the U.S. unchanged when it came to white supremacy, and locking black women out of the rooms and halls of power, even though those very black women were the ones who kicked in the doors. Brittany Packnett Cunningham is a voting rights activist and the co-founder of Campaign Zero, an organization that focuses on policy solutions to ending police brutality here in the U.S. And she had lots to share.
I mean, the role of black women has been essential to the very fabric of democracy in this country, always, right? That we constantly discuss the founding fathers, but if we are not thinking of Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and Ida B. Wells and Barbara Jordan and Shirley Chisholm as our founding mothers, then we have missed the point entirely, because black women have continuously been the backbone of democracy for America, even and frankly, especially when we were not honored for it.
It was a muggy August day in 1970, and the chatter of the House had yet to quiet and soften as Shirley Chisholm made her way to the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, her signature glasses catching and reflecting the light as she peered out at the sea of white, mostly male faces. She paused, standing rooted in the spot, demanding their attention. And in time, they gave it, leaning back in their chairs, prepared to be wholly unimpressed by the impressive woman who stood before them, urging those within the room to understand and support the Equal Rights Amendment.
Mr. Speaker, House Joint Resolution 264 before us today, which provides the equality under the law for both men and women, represents one of the most clear-cut opportunities we are likely to have to declare our faith in the principles that shaped our Constitution. It provides a legal basis for attack on the most subtle, most pervasive, and the most institutionalized form of prejudice that exists. Discrimination against women solely on the basis of their sex is so widespread that it seems to many persons normal, natural, and right. The argument that this amendment will not solve the problem of sex discrimination is not relevant. If the argument were used against a civil rights bill, as it has been used in the past, the prejudice that lies behind it would be embarrassing. Of course, laws will not eliminate prejudice from the hearts of human beings, but that is no reason to allow prejudice to continue to be enshrined in our laws, to perpetuate injustice through inaction.
Her voice did not shake. It did not waver. This was the same Shirley Chisholm who was the first black woman ever elected to Congress in 1968. The very same Shirley Chisholm who in 1972 would announce her bid to be the Democratic nominee for President of the United States.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am Black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am not the candidate of any political bosses or fat cats or special interests. Here now, without endorsements from many big-name politicians or celebrities or any other kind of prop, I do not intend to offer to you the tired and glib cliches which for too long have been accepted part of our political life. I am the candidate of the people of America.
But the year was still 1968, and Shirley Chisholm still had things she needed to say that day on the floor of the House of Representatives.
This is what it comes down to. Artificial distinctions between persons must be wiped out of the law. Legal discrimination between the sexes is, in almost every instance, founded on outmoded views of society and pre-scientific beliefs about psychology and physiology. It is time to sweep away these relics of the past and set further generations free of them.
Shirley Chisholm is one Black woman in the line of Black women who stretch back into history, but often found themselves in similar roles. When she stood there on the floor of the House of Representatives urging her white peers to support the Equal Rights Amendment, and when she announced her run for presidency, it was clear that she was speaking to the entirety of the country. Fighting for the liberation of Black people meant fighting for the liberation of all people. Through the lens of race in the U.S., there is no freedom when the least of us is caged. And there are lessons being taken from the failures of the early suffragist movement in America.
I often will use that lesson of suffrage as a lesson for today, that if our movements are not as inclusive and equitable and just as the world we seek to create, then we will get to the world we've created and suddenly realize we've left a lot of people behind. And we have to be determined to build sufficient movements and not just efficient movements. We hear all the time, it will take too long if we include everyone. Wait your turn. Let's get this win and then we'll come to you. Well, how long should people have to delay their fundamental rights? How long should people have to silence their humanity for the sake of people with greater privilege? There is a real lesson in that. I think we've repeated the improper history far too many times within movements. And I'm hopeful, especially as I look at younger generations right now, that we will stop repeating those mistakes of history and start actually living into the lessons of history. And the suffragette movement is no different. The wins were obviously significant, but they were limited. And we have needed freedom for as long as we have been on these shores. And therefore, we've had to go invent it. We've had to imagine what it can look like. We've had to plan backwards from that imagined reality and actually put our hand to the plow and get to the business of creating the freedom that we seek. I look back across history and I see all of the many roads that Black women not only took, but literally had to carve out in order to get to this place. And the many roads that Black women from the halls of policy to the streets are taking and carving out right now for the future. It is deeply inspiring.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll conclude our audio docudrama right after this. This is 1A.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week, or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
This is 1A. Let's get back to the conclusion of our audio docudrama based on the fight for women's suffrage at the turn of the century. Here's Sasha Ann Simons.
Inspiring though it may be, the right to vote in the U.S. is still under attack. From the voter suppression seen during the Georgia governor's race of 2018, during which the current governor, Brian Kemp, oversaw the purging of more than 668,000 voters from the Georgia voter registry. The majority of the voters purged were Black and brown. And this right to vote, fought for by so many for so long, still isn't guaranteed to all of us equally.
I just am really, really clear that the legacy of this 100 years is facing the reality that the franchise still is not equally accessed by all Americans, by all people, and that it remains obstructed for formerly incarcerated folks, for immigrants, for people of color, for indigenous people, for poor people, for housing insecure people, for elders, and most certainly for Black people.
Just because something has yet to be doesn't mean it can't one day be possible. And the right to vote is no different. So we'll leave you with more Fannie Lou Hamer. She says it best.
I've never been hung up in all of my work in just fighting for the Black. I've never been hung up in that because I know that a lot of Black people have given their lives. But I also know it was people like Andy Goodman, Michael Swerner, and James Chaney that gave their lives in the state of Mississippi that all of us would have a better chance. And when they died there, they didn't just die for me, but they died for you, because your freedom is shackled and chained to mine. And until I'm free, you are not free either.
That was a special audio feature mixing fiction and nonfiction written by 1A producer Morgan Givens, with reporting from 1A correspondent Sasha Ann Simons. And a special thanks to Brittany Packnett Cunningham, co-founder of Campaign Zero. That's an organization that researches policy-backed solutions to ending police brutality. And Kate Clark LeMay, a historian at the National Portrait Gallery. Kate's exhibit, Votes for Women, is part of the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative, titled Because of Her Story. Once again, today's producer was Morgan Givens. 1A correspondent Sasha Ann Simons contributed reporting to the feature, and 1A producer Jonquilin Hill voiced Shirley Chisholm in 1970. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.